Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. This week we conclude our four-part series on the history of U.S. involvement in the war in Vietnam. Nicholas Capasso joins us to examine the political and cultural impact of the Vietnam Veterans Memorial in Washington, D.C., and Michael Haney has the last word, in which he compares the American experience in Vietnam to that of the Soviets in Afghanistan. But before we hear from them, Joey Skidmore takes a look at an important event that occurred this week in history.
This week in history, on January 27, 1973, agreements ending the war in Vietnam were signed in Paris. The peace accords called for a general ceasefire. The United States agreed to withdraw its troops, and the North Vietnamese promised to release all U.S. and other prisoners of war. The DMZ at the 17th parallel would continue to be the dividing line between North and South Vietnam, but reunification would be pursued through peaceful means. All foreign troops would be withdrawn from Cambodia and Laos, and the establishment of bases and troop movements in those countries was prohibited. The North Vietnamese agreed to the South Vietnamese people's right to self-determination, and all parties agreed to appoint an international control commission to monitor the agreement.
Turning to items of historical interest in the news, experts are once again taking up the question, who killed King Tut? The boy king died young and was buried in haste, and now a pair of U.S. gumshoes armed with modern forensics is trying to find out why. The tomb of the boy king created a sensation when it was uncovered in 1922. One of the few royal burial chambers that survived relatively intact, it was by far the richest, filled with gold, ivory, and other treasures. But there were also signs of foul play. Tut was barely 18 when he died, and he was the son of a controversial pharaoh. Many guessed he was murdered. More than 3,300 years after his death, Greg Cooper, a former FBI profiler and chief of police in Provo, Utah, and Mike King, director of the Ogden, Utah Police Department's Crime Analysis Unit, have tackled the case and employed modern forensic methods to the evidence. In their anatomical studies, they discovered a sliver of bone floating in Tut's brain cavity, and a dense area at the base of his skull, a blood clot, that suggests he may have been killed by a blow to the back of the head which caused him to fall to the ground and strike his head. They also found that the boy king suffered from fused vertebrae that hindered his ability to move freely his torso and head. This infirmity, the team maintains, made the fatal fall all the more likely. This is Talking History.
Thank you.
our series of shows on the history of American involvement in the Vietnam War, we've examined the air war, the role of the media in that conflict, and POWs and MIAs. This week, we look at the creation and impact of the Vietnam Veterans Memorial in Washington, D.C. Fred Nielsen, professor of history at the University of Nebraska at Omaha, and the interviewer for this series, takes up the subject with his guest, Nicholas Capasso.
The Vietnam Veterans Memorial was unveiled in 1982 amid controversy reminiscent of the war it remembered. But in the years since, it has often transcended those divisions, becoming a place of pilgrimage and healing, and a symbol of national unity. With me today is Nick Capasso, who has written widely on the history and meaning of the Vietnam Memorial. He is the curator of the Decordova Museum and Sculpture Park in Lincoln, Massachusetts. Mr. Capasso, welcome.
Thank you.
You've written that the Vietnam Memorial was the first truly commemorative national monument in America since the turn of the 20th century. Among other things, that's a reminder that World War II, a far larger conflict than Vietnam, was not memorialized in the same way. Why not?
Well, I think that's the result of a confluence of politics, economics, and aesthetics that at mid-century was known as the Living Memorial Movement. And living memorials are basically utilitarian structures like highways and stadiums and roads that are commemorative in name only. In other words, you dedicate a stadium to the veterans of the war, and you get a memorial and a public works project. And given the need for employment when all the vets came home from the Second World War and the need to build infrastructure in the 1950s, this all kind of came together with a lot of support from the architecture community to veer commemoration away from artwork and towards public works.
The decline in public commemoration seems to reach a low point in the 1960s. You describe that decade as the nadir for public commemorations.
Yeah, that's right. For a number of reasons. Public art in the 1960s was dominated by abstract sculpture. Taste in public art had veered very far away from what we traditionally think of as monuments, statues of soldiers, generals on horseback, things like that. And in the 1960s, there was no new relevant artistic language developed yet for commemoration. Statues were seen in retrospect as kitsch by a lot of the public, and there was a lot of like public derision of these old-fashioned monuments. There was also something else going on in the 1960s in urban development. There was an open space movement. And the adherence to this idea in urban planning and park design wanted, literally, open spaces in the cities, and they didn't want the open spaces cluttered up with statues and artworks and you know, any kind of commemorative structures.
Given that context, the lack of interest in traditional memorials during the 60s, the Vietnam Memorial seems to have been erected with astonishing speed. The war ended in 1973. The memorial was proposed in 1979 and unveiled just 3 years later. What accounts for that turnaround, for the speed in the erection of the monument?
Yeah, I have to add, that's a world's record for a national monument. You know, it took over 50 years for the Washington Monument from the time it was conceived until it was completed. The Lincoln Memorial took 30-odd years. The FDR Memorial was conceived in 1955 and was only dedicated in 1997. Federal memorials, for lots of different reasons, take forever. But what happened with the Vietnam Memorial is that the Vietnam vets who wanted this to happen benefited from the political climate at the time. At the time, and we're talking about the late 1970s, Vietnam vets were held in very low regard in this country. They were seen as drug-addled bums, and that's how they were depicted in the media. And the erection of a national memorial was a politically expedient way for politicians to support the vets and try to turn around their image, you know, rather than doing something substantive like fund Agent Orange research.
Apart from those political considerations, ulterior motives almost, what were the announced purposes of the memorial to be?
They were very clearly stated. Because there was a national design competition, there were parameters laid out that everyone was, you know, all the entrants were supposed to follow. And what they wanted, what these vets wanted, was a memorial that would honor all the veterans of the war and that would list the names of all the personnel killed or missing in action. And they also wanted a place on the National Mall in Washington, D.C., that would be contemplative and harmonious with its site. And those are really the only rules that were laid out in terms of the purpose of the memorial.
I believe you mentioned that the committee, the jury that oversaw the entrance, commented on Maya Lin's winning design by saying that it would provide a place of healing as well for
That's
the country.
That's right. That's right. I mean, the Maya Lin's design sort of went above and beyond the call of duty. It turned out to be better than anyone envisioned this memorial could to be.
She, of course, is the designer of the part of the memorial that is the wall.
That's correct.
You describe her wall as a relatively new kind of monument, a participatory memorial. Could you talk a little bit about that, please?
Yes. All right. If we think back to traditional monuments, like the statue of a soldier, that's an object that viewers of the memorial regard in a fairly passive way. You stand there and you look at it. Maya Lin's wall works very differently. First of all, it's much larger than a statue. It's 500 feet long. So there is no way to just stand back and behold it and experience the memorial. What you have to do is enter its space and walk along that wall. And as you walk along, you kind of sink in elevation and the wall rises, so you're kind of descending into it. You have to, you wind up becoming part of the memorial as you experience it over time and space. The other thing that happens with the Vietnam Memorial is, you know, on the surface of the wall are inscribed all the names of the veterans, but it's also a mirror surface. It's polished to a sheen, and when people go and walk down into the memorial, they see the reflection as part and parcel of the artwork, and they see the reflection laid over the names of the dead and the missing. And not only is that a very profound emotional experience, it also literally makes visitors part of the monument.
It's become such a place of pilgrimage now, and you've commented that it was for many years and may still be one of the most visited places in Washington,
yeah,
D.C.
It still is.
Still
yes.
is? Okay. And yet, 20 years ago, when it was unveiled, it was extremely controversial.
Oh, yes.
you quote Secretary of the Interior James Watt, who is, as Secretary, oversaw what went in the mall, as calling it an act of treason. What were the objections to the wall?
Well, a lot of people objected to the design because the design flew in the face of what people traditionally thought a monument should be. Monuments in the past, dating back to ancient Egypt, had been vertical. They had been white rather than black. They had, if they had listed names, the names were listed alphabetically or by unit rather than chronologically. All of these things were new, and all of these things were unprecedented, and it made people very uncomfortable. And I hasten to add here that all of these objections were based on models and renderings of what the wall was going to look like. Once the piece was actually unveiled and dedicated, and people could get a sense of the power of the experience of this place, all those objections vanished.
The objections vanished, and yet it didn't stop people from adding to it. One of the results of the objections is the addition eventually of the statues of three soldiers, a more traditional kind of commemoration.
Well, that addition was made before Maya Lin's monument was unveiled. This was a political compromise that was struck. The vets who were commissioning the monument, in order to get a construction permit from the Department of the Interior, which was then run by James Watt, had to promise to also erect on the site a more traditional monument of the three soldiers that was designed by Frederick Hart. To appease the conservative critics of the design. You have to remember, this is in the middle of the Reagan era. And so the compromise was made before the wall was dedicated. It was a done deal.
And when that's erected, there's yet another addition.
Oh, yes. Yeah, Frederick Hart, who designed what's known as the Three Fighting Men, which is the figurative component of the memorial, you have to give him a certain amount of credit, because what he did, he has a group of three soldiers, and one of them is African-American. And this is the first depiction of an African-American individual in any federal monument in the country. So his attempt at being inclusive was, I think, heartfelt and sincere, but what he forgot to do was to include the over 10,000 women who served in Vietnam. And this offended women veterans of the war mightily, and they organized to commission and dedicate their own memorial to women who served in the Vietnam War, and they were successful in doing that. And in 1993, the Women's Vietnam Veterans Memorial, designed by Glenna Goodacre, was dedicated.
The memorial, and I suppose I'm thinking here particularly of the wall, is so overpowering and so moving. But I wonder, I'm not sure quite how to ask this question. If part of its power comes from the fact that the war it commemorates was lost. Would it be possible to have a comparably moving memorial of a successful war, World War II, for example?
Oh, I think it's possible. I think that for some people who visit the wall, some of the power does come from contemplating, you know, the fact that these people may have died in vain, you know, from one individual's political perspective. That's a testament, I think, to one of the things about the memorial is that it's intentionally ambiguous politically. It doesn't celebrate victory, and it doesn't mourn defeat. It lets viewers bring their own baggage to remembering the event. That's also very it's unique, I think, in memorial design. It was a great innovation, and it bothered a lot of people who wanted a heroic monument. But the other thing I want to say about this is that I think the power of the memorial resides primarily in the design and in the participatory nature of the design. You can have good and bad memorials to any war, to any event. There are plenty of not really good memorials to the Vietnam War, and, you know, the fact remains that, you know, in some people's minds, the war was lost. So I don't think it really depends on the tenor of the remembrance of whether there's victory or defeat. I think it depends a lot more on the design.
One of the purposes of the memorial was to serve as a symbol of national unity, and I suppose it's fair to say it succeeded in large measure in accomplishing that. But that leads me to wonder if a successful commemoration, in this case at least, is somewhat at odds with historical understanding. What we have here is a memorial that strives to unite Americans, even as it commemorates a war that bitterly divided them.
Right. Well, I think that, let's see, there are a lot of possible answers to this question, but in terms of the Vietnam Memorial providing national unity, yes, it provided national unity, a national unity of respect for and gratitude towards the veterans who fought in that war. I do not believe that it provided any kind of national unity about the political or moral assessment of that war.
And so, as you've said before, it's intentional ambiguity allows people still to go there and read into the monument and into the war, for that matter, what they bring to it and what they choose to see.
That's right. And I think that, you know, the monument's purpose, or any monument's purpose, is to evoke or elicit memory and to move the emotions. And I think nothing succeeds better than that, in that mission, than the wall. I don't think anyone ever intended it to provide national unity. And I don't think in a democracy any memorial should try to attempt that. This is a democracy. The country is never going to be 100% behind anything. And God forbid that should ever happen.
Mr. Capasso, why don't we leave it there?
Thank
you so much for visiting with us.
My pleasure.
I've been visiting with Nick Capasso, the curator of the De Cordova Museum and Sculpture Park in Lincoln, Massachusetts.
Commentary of the Week, Michael Haney compares American involvement in Vietnam to the Soviet experience in Afghanistan a decade later, focusing on similarities in combat experiences and the fate of their returning soldiers. Haney is completing his Ph.D. studies in history at Rutgers University.
In the decade between 1979 and 1989, the former Soviet Union fought and lost a brutal and devastating war in Afghanistan. In many ways, the war was similar to the war America fought and lost in Vietnam. While comparisons between the two wars have been made often enough, two topics have gotten relatively little attention. First, the similarity between the combat experience of both nations' soldiers, and second, the similarity between the homecoming and readjustment experience of both nations' combat veterans. In both wars, American and Soviet soldiers found themselves in confusing, brutalizing, and often frustrating combat situations, consistently winning large-scale battles in the field while somehow gradually losing the larger, longer war. In each case, it became harder and harder for soldiers to grasp the point of official strategy, hard even to discern friend from foe, while living always under the threat of hostilities initiated at times and places of the enemy's choosing. The ambush, the nighttime rocket attack, the booby trap. In both wars, the intensity of actual fighting was extremely high. For those assigned to combat units, killed in action rates ranged as high as 50%, a loss rate comparable to the worst rates of World War II. Few American or Soviet ground soldiers were taken prisoner. Atrocities became all too routine on all sides. And when each nation's combatants came home from the war, both experienced remarkably similar episodes of post-war adjustment problems. In both cases, veterans returned to nations now run largely by the World War II generation, a generation that often expressed puzzlement, or worse, at its younger counterparts' failure to win their war. In the U.S., some returning veterans were chastised as baby killers. In the USSR, veterans in uniform might be asked where they had managed to purchase their military medals. In time, medical specialists in the U.S. noticed what they regarded as an unusually high level of post-war dysfunction among former combat soldiers, ranging from traditional forms of mental illness, such as manic depression, to less obvious conditions, like drug or alcohol abuse, homelessness, and suicide. Labeled post-traumatic stress disorder, news of the new phenomenon rapidly spread among returning Soviet veterans. They, in turn, began noticing similar occurrences among their own veteran population, and many reached out to their counterparts in the U.S. for help and advice. Vietnam and Afghanistan pitted the world's two mightiest military forces against two much smaller, much less lavishly equipped, third world armies. How did the two superpowers lose? Scholars, politicians, and others will undoubtedly continue to clash over their reasons far into the future. In the meantime, for the 350,000 or so Americans who saw significant combat in Vietnam, and for the 100,000 or so former Soviets who did likewise in Afghanistan, the two wars' painful parallels will endure, along with their own scars.
You've been listening to Michael Haney, doctoral student of history at Rutgers University. This is Talking History. Finally, we recommend to you one last site where you can learn more about American involvement in the Vietnam War, the site which was the subject of this week's interview, the Vietnam Veterans Memorial. Joey Skidmore returns to give you a few more specifics on the memorial.
As you just heard, a group of Vietnam veterans wanted all Americans to remember the service and sacrifice of their compatriots. Because of their efforts, the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, designed by Maya Lin, stands today on the Washington Mall. The memorial consists of three main elements: the wall, which was dedicated in 1982, and that includes the names of 58,226 deceased and missing veterans, the three servicemen statue, erected by Frederick Hart in 1984, and the Vietnam Women's Memorial, designed by Glenna Goodacre in 1993. In the fall of 1982, a U.S. Navy officer walked up to the trench where the concrete for the foundation of the wall was being poured. He stood over the trench for a moment, then tossed something into it and saluted. A workman asked what he was doing, and he said he was giving his dead brother's Purple Heart to the wall. His was the first of thousands of similar offerings, poems and letters, Bibles, and other personal mementos made by Americans at the memorial over the past 20 years, and they have become an important part of the memorial as well. Volunteers collect these offerings each day, and the National Park Service is preserving many of them in the Vietnam Veterans Memorial Collection at the Smithsonian, which is open to the public.
And that's it for this week's program and our special series on the history of American involvement in the Vietnam War. We'd like to thank G. Kurt Peeler, director of the Center for the Study of War and Society at the University of Tennessee, for his help in organizing the series, and Fred Nielsen of the University of Nebraska at Omaha for conducting the interviews. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians, and as usual, we invite your comments on the series and suggestions for future programs, either by email at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or by U.S. mail at Talking History, care of the Department of History, University of Missouri, Kansas City, Kansas City, Missouri, 64110. Until next time, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.